She's a little wild now.
Yeah, I just did. Okay, call to order the House Committee on Education, the Interim Committee on Education. Welcome. Got, why are all guys sitting in the back of the room there? Just like class, isn't it? Got to watch those guys in the back of the room. Okay, the first thing we're going to do is have an informational hearing on the committee bill presentations, and then actually before some folks have to take off at 9, hopefully we'll be able to vote to move them forward. So with that, Dr. Gavin. Okay, open the informational hearing, and first on LC 224, Chuck Bennett, Jim Green, General Ingram, and that's it. And anybody else that wants to speak on this. Are you guys going to say what the LC is, or do you want Richard to explain it? Or to say what it is? Okay.
I don't have to do anything.
Yeah. Thanks, Chuck.
Thanks, Chuck. Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is on LC 224, which is a committee LC, and it would exempt retired members of PERS, of the PERS system, from limitations on reemployment as long as they're being reemployed as a speech-language pathologist or speech-language pathology assistant.
Okay, thank you. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Chuck Bennett. I'm with the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. We strongly support introduction of the bill, look forward to hearings during the February session. We think what you'll find as we go through the discussion that there is a real need for this bill in districts around the state. It continues a program that's been in place and will substantially serve the needs of special education children that are served by this particular category of specialist in our schools. So we'd ask you to introduce the bill, and then we'll go into hearing later.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Lori Satin's bill. I am not Jim Green. I have a hair. Here in support, I...
It's on the record now.
What I did is I checked with PERS on the LC to be sure the language met what they needed. Specifically, our concern was that this sunsetted in January, and this won't be effective until February, and people working, and obviously no one's going to have the kind of hours that impacts them. So they added some language in the LC Section 3 that PERS was very glad to see, so we're here in support of the introduction.
Okay, thank you.
And I'm Kathy DeDomingo. I'm representing the Oregon Speech and Hearing Association, and we absolutely hope that you will move forward with this bill. Speech-language pathologists have traditionally served in the schools in assuring that kids are best able to learn and take full advantage. And in the rural districts in particular, they have a tremendous difficulty recruiting new speech pathologists. And in order to have new recruits come in, there needs to be licensed speech therapists on site to train the next generation. So this is about getting kids what they need, as well as bringing along the next generation.
Okay, thank you. Do you have any questions? Ms. Barreto?
Yeah. There's a shortage, then, of speech language pathologists?
In the schools, and there has been for many years.
In this committee last session, there was the information that we put out 1,500 teachers a year through our colleges, and we only have 500 openings every year. Mm-hmm. And I've been hitting most of the college presidents about this, as far as them understanding where the fields of opportunity are and not having a glut of students coming out with a degree where there's a shortage of jobs. And so I would just say I think this is an area, if there's a opening and an opportunity for this, and we see this going down into the future, that the colleges ought to be on board with this, saying, look, we can start producing some of these teachers, short order.
We do have three universities in the state, University of Oregon, Portland State, and Pacific University, who too have graduate speech-language pathology programs. But those programs typically only graduate about 35 to 40 candidates a year. And once a new graduate achieves that, they still have a supervised year where they have a mentor, at least by phone, somewhere close. So we're only producing about 90 new graduates a year.
follow-up? So how many openings are there a year in this field?
You know, yesterday, I took a look at what are the openings, and predominantly I see them in the rural areas, and I counted, I think, probably 10 just looking yesterday, and these are existing openings, not even looking at the next school year. And a lot of what I'm seeing is these are openings that are being filled right now by telemedicine companies who are providing remote speech-language pathology access to the students. So,
Madam Chair, if I may, Representative, what we would like to do during the hearing is discuss with you this particular specialty. There are a batch of them. This bill actually came to us and the School Boards Association to get introduction from Salem Kaiser School District,
yeah,
which is has a lot of openings and no takers. It's a common across the board. It's very common in these particular kind of specialties, and we've done a survey, and that would be part of our testimony when the bill comes in front of you in February. We'll bring in folks from the sort of special ed directors to tell you about the shortages in a whole range of these areas, and you are right on target in the kind of discussion as to how do you get students in the education training fields into these specialties, or people with these specialties to look at the education field as the place to apply it. And there are issues there that we would like to explore with you in a more appropriate forum in terms of this session.
And just for clarification, because this will go down, this is not a new issue. My prior life, I worked for the Oregon Education Association. I did something that went against my grain. We placed speech and language pathologists higher on the salary schedule than what their experience was. And the reason is we could not get them because they were staying in private sector. It is not an easy course to go through.
Yeah.
It is a very, very specialized field. I worked in the speech and hearing at Portland State. Mm-hmm. And we could not get them because we could not compete with the salaries we were making in private sector. So that's the one thing that, and they're usually certified by
by the American Speech and
the qualifications very, very difficult. So we'll be going into a lot of background on this. But this, they've had a shortage for as long as I've been involved in education. So anyway,
and that's with the third school opening.
Yeah, that was with Pacific opening. So yes,
thank you, Madam Chair.
Hack.
The question I had is, now the PERS, once they're retired, my understanding is they can only work 1,040 hours. So will this exempt them from that requirement? And will the language only allow them to, so they're going to be able to draw their PERS, they're going to be able to work full-time, be paid to work full-time. Will they be accumulating additional PERS dollars?
No.
So they won't accumulate any PERS dollars, but they'll be drawing PERS, working full-time. Will the language contain verbiage that says they can only work in that field for a certain amount of time? Are we going to, what, can you talk to us a little bit about?
Madam Chair, Representative Hack, again, exemption for a specific period of time to which the sunset moves to 2026, and then they reassess. And there's some other industries, including nursing, that have the same, and we're trying to tack them together so we can relook at this. As stated by both parties here, there is a shortage, and it's intended for them to work in that arena and be exempt from any PERS implications, and they can continue to draw. They could still, as that retiree, go work in some other position unrelated to PERS on their own.
Mm-hmm. But this is expanding just, expanding the sunset.
Yes.
It's already
in place.
So, one other, if I may. This has been an ongoing issue for years and years and years, and we have not come up with any other solution than this.
We've had a variety of, and they one of them is here in your district, representative through Willamette ESD. In terms of sort of fast tracking training, we've tried all kinds of stuff. We would really ask that we be allowed to have the bill introduced and then come, if it's decided, okay, come to hearing with people who can really deep dive and give you really carefully accurate and planned answers on this stuff. You're taking us into some detail that would better be, I think, served in hearing, if you don't mind.
Yep, understandable.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, LC 225, David Williams, Beaverton School District. Yes, if you could explain what it is.
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, LC 225 relates to residency for school purposes after district boundary changes. There's an example that Mr. Williams can get into.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, David Williams with the Beaverton School District. What you have before you is a draft at the request of the school district. We've been, for the last 6 months, going through a process with the Hillsborough School District, a conversation around our adjoining boundary and where it does and does not make sense to perhaps adjust that boundary to better serve students. In particular, if you're familiar with the area, there is an area of what's called South Cooper Mountain, which we're building a brand new high school in, where development is about to happen, that is in the Hillsborough School District currently. And then another area of the South Hillsborough area, which is in the Beaverton School District currently and would be undergoing development in the next 5 to 10 years. The districts essentially have agreed to swap those two pieces of land, not that we don't own the land, to swap the boundaries around those lands so that the students in the South Cooper Mountain area would attend the Beaverton School District, thus avoiding a lengthy drive or expense incurred by the Hillsborough School District to build a new school in that area, and the students in the South Hillsborough area would attend, in the future would attend the Hillsborough School District. Both sides agreed, however, that in the interest of what is best for kids, the kids that are in those areas now, and we're talking about one student in the South Cooper Mountain area and about 25 students in the South Hillsborough area, that those students should be allowed to choose to stay in their current school district if they want to. They can stay currently enrolled in their school district that they attend now. The trouble, however, as we begin to unravel the new laws and regulations around inter-district transfer, is we had no legal ability to do that. Because you cannot preference a student from specific geographic areas, we had no way to essentially grandfather those students in under current process. So the bill before you, the legislative council draft before you, would essentially allow for a student whose residency status has changed as a result of a boundary change, that student may choose to remain in their current school district so long as they remain current. I'm thinking of the wrong word. So long as they always remain enrolled. It's a one-way street. They can't say go to Hillsborough and then to say they want to go back to Beaverton. It doesn't work that way. They stay continuously enrolled. They may stay in that school district, and that allows that.
Okay, thank you. Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What are we dealing with in terms of siblings?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Frederick. Excellent question. Siblings becomes a bit less of a tricky issue because inter-district transfer does allow us to preference siblings of currently enrolled students. So the key is getting the current student enrolled so that they can stay. Once that student is enrolled, the districts can, under current statute, preference their sibling. So say a third grader now would be allowed to stay, and their sibling is a preschooler, obviously not enrolled. With that third grader remaining in the district, through inter-district transfer, I can preference siblings, and Hillsborough in inter-district transfer for release can preference siblings. So the two districts can do that for siblings. We simply can't do it for that first instance of the student remaining in the district.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just affirming that this change in statute would apply to everybody. It's not just crafted for this situation.
Correct. Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Wilson. Yes, the statute would apply to any instance of a boundary adjustment. It doesn't need dual boundary adjustments such as we are doing. This is merely highlighted this, what we perceive as a little bit of a glitch in the interdistrict transfer law. I'm not aware of anybody who's currently considering other boundary changes, and certainly there has been very few over the last, say, decade of school districts changing boundaries, but it would apply for all districts.
And a clarification, it is two school districts that are changing boundaries as opposed to when you change boundaries inside your own school district.
Correct. It would have no impact on in-district boundaries at all.
Representative McLean.
That's my question.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, the last committee bill that we have is LC-233, which is actually one that is was brought to me. And what this, if I may speak from the dais, what this LC deals with is basically bullying and cyberbullying. It was brought to our attention that a lot of we're having a lot of issues, especially with cyberbullying. And so what this does is the current law deals with what they refer to as the hostile education environments, and it prohibits bullying, cyberbullying, harassment, and intimidation. What this is, the school districts are required to have a process for individuals to report instances and to report this information to ODE. And what this LC does is it directs the State Board of Ed to adopt by rule a complaint process by which individuals are able to report a district policy that is allegedly in violation of the state law prohibiting harassment, intimidation, bullying, and cyberbullying, but also require the board to adopt rules related to evaluating and reporting process for these allegations, because currently there is no kind of meat behind it. They can go through and say every district has a policy on intimidation and bullying and all of these kind of things. But if the process is not being followed, there's not a recourse. So that's what this bill does. Any questions?
It sounds like a fine idea. I just would like to know the cost of the unfunded mandate.
We don't know.
When we have a hearing.
Yeah.
When we have the hearing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Heads up.
Absolutely.
Cost to the district, not the state.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. Do we have unfunded mandates?
Occasionally. It's a rumor.
Okay. So anyway, that's what it is. Okay. With that, I close the informational hearing on the Kimmy bills, and I would like to open up what am I opening up?
A work session.
I'm going to be opening up a work session on these three bills for introduction to the of the committee measures to the floor. And again, reminding a vote on this does not indicate your agreement at all. It's just to move it out of committee. Representative Frederick.
Chair Doherty, I move that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC-224, LC-225, and LC-233.
Okay, Representative Frederick moves the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC-224, dated 12/3/15; LC-225, dated 1/5/16; and LC-233, dated 1/12/16. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none, is there any objection? Okay, seeing none, the measures will be introduced as committee bills. Thank you very much. Okay. Next informational hearing is on education-related LCs, and these were just, we won't know really almost until the end of the month exactly what bills will be coming to this committee and what are the education bills, but these are some that have been brought to our attention. So with that, I open an informational hearing, or informational meeting on education-related bills. Is Smith, where is he? Okay, so we will start out with LC-24 with Vern Sable, relating to concussions sustained by athletes. Okay. Thank you, Dr. Sabo.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, for the record, Dr. Vern Sabo representing the Oregon Chiropractic Association. This bill is straightforward. It kind of repairs a oversight last session with Senate Bill 521 dealing with concussion. What we're doing is adding chiropractic physicians and naturopathic physicians into statute as part of the healthcare providers, professionals that can assess an athlete and determine if they have the signs and symptoms of a concussion on the sidelines and determine whether or not they can be returned to play immediately. And then also for those who have suffered a concussion, documented concussion, also know when they can start beginning a graduated return to play and that the signs and symptoms of concussion or mild traumatic brain injury have been come along long enough so that they can, in fact, be start returning back to play and activity. There's a graduated process that takes place. So I've got chiropractic colleagues who currently serve as team physicians at the high school, college, university level, and also on the U.S. Olympic medical team, and then also professional sports, and have been doing so for decades. That completes my testimony. I'd be willing to answer any questions.
Okay. So that's one of the education-related bills that we're going to be
Madam Chair,
later.
Members of the committee, it's actually a Senate Education Committee, LC, so it could come here or it could go somewhere else.
Okay. Thank you very much for that clarification. Okay. Thank you, Dr. Sabo. Next, we have Doug Riggs. And, Doug's here. And on LC 63 with a question mark. And I'm also, this is also one of my bills, so we'll be having it in this committee. And, we're not really doing testimony,
right.
So
right.
Just introduction is done.
So, members of the committee, Madam Chair, Madam Vice Chair, Doug Riggs on behalf of the Alliance for Kids and also the School-Based Health Alliance in Oregon, and I'm going to run through this fairly quickly. I think that we've all talked about chronic absenteeism, and you've had presentations on graduation rates. We have been working with a large group of folks over the last year and a half to identify problems facing adolescent youth in particular, and we are here to share the research and some recommendations, so I'll be fairly brief if I can. As you all know, we are lagging behind in Oregon compared to other states as far as understanding the impact of adverse childhood experiences and trauma on children. And so in our view and the research for the last few years, we have not focused quite enough on these types of issues. The result is we're seeing absenteeism in education, which leads to absenteeism in the workforce, which leads to absenteeism in healthcare, we have a kind of a compounding impact over the years where kids who don't get the right services and kids who are not kept in school over a long period of time and kids who do not graduate become the high flyers in ER, become the problems in the correction system, et cetera. So this is not just an educational issue. You know, we like to point at the education system in K-12 and say it's the teacher's fault or it's the administrator's fault or they ought to be doing a better job on educating kids and keeping them in school. What the research has shown is that it's a lot of factors both inside and outside the school that need to be addressed. And so the proposal we have here attempts to bring that all together. As you know, we have seen a decrease in graduation rates in the state, and so we're trying to address that issue. So just to give you some quick background, we've had a variety of events that have been outside of this building, have incorporated between 250 and 350 folks. At the last summit that we had last July, probably 60% of the participants were guidance counselors, attendance counselors, assistant principals, in-classroom teachers, et cetera. The other 40% represented folks from the CCOs, from the medical professionals, behavioral health, mental health, et cetera, and the national experts who we brought in. So series of events, you can see some of the sponsors on the lower right-hand side of the slide. But you can see it's a very wide variety of groups who you well know who've been involved in this effort. The challenge really is, you know, children are provide challenges. I have two. I have a 16-year-old. I also have an 18-year-old who just went off to college. And they have all sorts of excuses and all sorts of reasons for not attending class, not wanting to do their homework. But it, the cumulative impact of that is on all the issues that we faced. This is the problem, and I think I'll let Maureen get more into it, but this was an upstream public health report that was compiled and reported on in October of 2014, and we can provide you with a copy of the report that indicated
okay, that. Okay, and this will be done when we have testimony.
Right. So a lot of factors that impact chronic absenteeism and trauma and high ACE scores, and this is a slide just to show you that what we're trying to do is get at not just a single focus of a solution, but really a broad-based solution that involves many parties. The last thing I'll point out before I leave is that last week, the President signed into law a bipartisan education bill that came out of the House and the Senate, the Every Student Succeeds Act. This is, trauma-informed care is a national model that has been test-run in many places and has been very successful. Section 4108 of that bill sets up a grant project or grant program for states and school districts to be able to apply for grants for trauma-informed care. The states to the front of the line and the first states applying who have a program in place for trauma-informed care will be the most likely to get funding. This bill that we're talking about in LC63 would put us at the front of the line. So I will let Maureen give a quick update on her perspective, and then we'll
conclude. Just by information, last when we had the long session, we did talk about this. Remember, I brought in an article from the Seattle Times on a program in the Seattle schools that are dealing with trauma kids, and this is basically what this sort of thing is. So right. I'm sure you all remember that.
Yeah, that. Madam Chair, I'll just point out that Christopher Blodgett, who I think you saw speak and whose work was referenced in the article, was our keynote speaker last summer and inspired the group when we wanted the work groups to come up with the proposal we've come up with. So.
Okay, thank you. Maureen?
Chair Doherty and members of the committee, my name is Maureen Hinman. I'm from the Oregon School-Based Health Alliance. So Doug talked a little bit about ACEs, and I just had some stats, which I won't read, but I'll highlight that children who have an ACE score of 3 out of 10 are 5 times more likely to have severe attendance issues, and that we know that kids in Oregon are experiencing trauma, both from our data and from, our experience. So this bill is our attempt to mitigate those effects. We would like to introduce the idea of piloting trauma-informed schools in Oregon. And we have a definition of trauma-informed school that I'm proposing get added to the bill. A trauma-informed school realizes both the widespread impact of trauma and the roles of schools in promoting resiliency, recognizes the signs and symptoms of trauma in students, families, and staff, responds by fully integrating knowledge about trauma into policies, procedures, and practices, and strives to both actively resist re-traumatization of students and staff and foster resiliency. So this is not simply an intervention. A trauma-informed school community offers a tiered support from prevention to intervention, or in school language, from the green zone to the red zone, so that all students, regardless of race and income and family background, have equitable access to protective factors. The key components of the bill, we're proposing a 3-year pilot using existing trauma-informed models from around the nation that are tailored specifically to Oregon communities, using resources that are already existing in the school and in the community, but pulling them together and coordinating them across the school, the CCO, public health, nonprofits, the justice system, perhaps the early learning hubs and the RACs if they exist in that particular community. We propose that a school-based health center or a similar existing school-based behavioral health equivalent be a part of the pilot so as to remove the barrier of having a place to provide intervention throughout the pilot. And we're recommending that we require a minimum community match for each project, as well as pursuit of the federal funding if it becomes available. And then a comprehensive evaluation of the project would be done, which would include documenting replicable components. So we've seen good outcomes in other schools. We can go ahead and move past that. And Oregon is ready for this. We know that physical and mental health providers are incorporating it into their practices, and some schools are also starting to go that direction. Right now there's a 7-district collaborative that is working on how to do this in schools in Oregon. We've developed this proposal with input from all of the groups up there, and we've had overwhelming support. We expect a lot of endorsements as we move forward and have language. So thank you, and okay. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Okay, Representative Wilson.
Yeah, thanks, Madam Chair.
I know the heavy lifting will be done later, but situations of overlap with the pilot, how will it be determined if this program as a pilot is overlapping other things that already exist? And does that work? Is that a concern at all?
Madam Chair, Representative Wilson, I think it's a really good question. We had some of the groups that are already working on this as you come and meet with us in December. We had about a 3.5-hour meeting, and that's one of the things that I think we want to make sure doesn't happen, that we don't reinvent the wheel, so to speak. So what we're asking for is that school districts and their community partners put together a proposal. You know, I wouldn't be evaluating them, but if I was the chief education office evaluating the proposals, I'd tend to lean towards the ones that took advantage of existing activities and resources. The second thing we wanted to do is recognize that situations were different in, say, your district than in Burns or your district than in Tigard, and that these proposals need to be tailored to the on-the-ground activities and situations in those districts. So we hope that we'll get some very tailored, specific, community-specific proposals coming out of this proposal or this plan.
Thank you. Just a quick follow-up. How would you choose the communities for the pilot, or would this be statewide?
The concept in the bill is to issue an RFP put together by the chief education office. They've done the same thing with the early learning hubs, so we thought that was a good mechanism. And then it would be selected, I assume, through some sort of a committee through the chief education office. But I would expect that, as has been the case in other RFPs, that they'd want some geographic distribution. And also, part of the purpose of the pilots is to develop methods that work elsewhere. So piloting different tactics in different communities to see what works best. So if this works, it could be rolled out statewide at some point.
Thank you.
And I think part of it, what the whole idea behind this was, back in the olden days when we had child development specialists in every elementary and middle school, is kind of the same idea, be able to get trained professional, which is usually social workers, to go through and deal with some of these things. Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want you to, in the presentation, there was a group that was not mentioned that you had, I'm sure you've talked with, but please put it in the presentation that you talked with them. And that's the students.
Mm-hmm.
That was not there. It was, you had the experts, you had the adults, you had all sorts of other things, but there was no mention of the student, of asking the students what they thought would be appropriate.
Yeah. Well, and part of this was, is the emphasis of having it in kindergarten through third grade, because that's when, at least the program in Seattle, that's when a lot of the trauma kids are acting out. And that's when they need the sort of services. I mean, these are kids that just literally will be in class for 10 minutes and then will bolt. And then they'll bring them back and they'll bolt again, and so on and so forth. And they're finding out it's things like, you know, their dad beat up their mom the night before kind of thing. And so we needed specialists to go through and do this. So we're kind of looking back to the things that used to work and still do work but are no longer around. So, but thank you very much for that input. Anything else? Okay. Thank you very much. We'll be anxious to hear from you. Okay, next we have Superintendent Aaron Prince from Corvallis School District. Welcome. And this is with LC, which is a Senate LC 205.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Dodery, Vice Chair Springer and Frederick, and committee members. My name is Erin Prince, and I'm currently the superintendent of Corvallis School District. At the end of the 2015 session, we were tasked with coming back to this session with a proposal to put significant sideboards on what came to be known as the fifth-year programs. We were asked to look for a proposal that would address the following issues: ensure students were applying for federal financial aid, create equity across the state, ensure sustainability, focus on highest need students with an eye toward increasing high school graduation, create sideboards that limit the impact on the state school fund. We began meeting in Albany in September with a group that was open to all who were interested. School district and community college officials attended regularly from as far away from Redmond to Klamath Falls. Representatives from OSBA, ODE, the governor's office, and legislators also attended. This proposal that is memorialized in the draft legislation we received just yesterday reflects careful thinking on the part of the group and a major shift for many of the districts that currently offer services to students who have satisfied requirements for a standard diploma. I'll briefly describe the proposal this morning, and Senator Gelser will give a more complete presentation to the Senate Education Committee today, this afternoon. Senator cannot be here to present right now because she is chairing a hearing on child welfare.
And we'll be hearing
right now.
This when we hear the bill.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. So this bill describes the narrow circumstances under which a school district can claim state school funds for students who have satisfied the requirements of a standard high school diploma after 4 years of school. We give these students a name in the bill. They are called postgraduate scholars. The bill creates two sets of criteria. First, the criteria postgraduate scholars must meet to enroll in a program offered by a school district. Second, the criteria the school district must meet to allow postgraduate scholars to participate in their college credit program. Student eligibility, the student must not be eligible for Oregon Promise. The student must also complete the FAFSA. Finally, the student must live in the boundary area of the school district for which they graduated from high school and can only attend the community college that serves the area in which the high school is located. Districts must have written policies about how their program fits in the strategy to increase high school graduation rate. They must identify the criteria students must meet for attendance, course enrollment, GPA, and participation in regular face-to-face meetings with school district staff. They must have dedicated staff at a level that ensures one-to-one face-to-face meeting with each postgraduate scholar no less than twice a month. The district must have a written contract with the community college. The majority of students in the school district earning credit on a college campus may not be postgraduate scholars. In other words, college credit programs must primarily serve students with modified and extended diplomas, GEDs, homeless, foster, or corrections youth, kids who are not on track to graduate at the end of 10th grade, or current students who have not yet completed 12th grade. The district may only serve a student for one school year after they graduate from high school. As far as the funding, the reimbursement for postgraduate scholars is set to be reduced every year for 3 years. Districts will not get any extra weight for students. In the 16-17 school year, the districts can claim 1.0 for a full-time student. In 17-18, they can claim 0.85. In 18-19, they can claim 0.75. This means that beginning next year, our state will spend less on postgraduate scholars than they do this year. That is because so many of the students will move to the Oregon Promise program. The combination of the decreased reimbursement rate and the mandate that the majority of students earning college credit may not be postgraduate scholars helps control the growth of the spending of this program. The bill requires a report back to the legislator in 2018 to trigger further discussion about the funding mechanism in the 2019 session. At this point, ODE will be able to tell us how much money is claimed for postgraduate scholars. We will also have a better idea of which students are not covered by Oregon Promise that can be successful in post-secondary programs. The bill also requires the HEC to bring forward information about the costs and revenue claimed by community colleges related to postgraduate scholars. With this information as a backdrop, ODE is required to recommend the appropriate SSF weight, if any weight, for postgraduate scholars, or recommend an alternate funding source to ensure adequate support for students who do not meet the Oregon Promise GPA requirements to enroll in post-secondary education. We are committed to continuing the effort to looking at alternate funding mechanisms. We know for some people, the idea of providing any support to postgraduate scholars is not palatable. For others, preserving services for this population is a matter of equity. Kids not covered by Oregon Promise will disproportionately be low-income students, English language learners, students with disabilities, and students who struggled early in their high school career but were able to get back on track to graduate. We don't want to lose these kids. And to date, we have not yet identified a stable funding source to help support them. We see this as an initiative that increases high school graduation rates, which makes it something we can't walk away from. However, this proposal gives us time to target the program, create equity, and gather the data needed to identify the appropriate long-term funding source, which may or may not be SSF, in 2019. In the end, this bill reduces what we are spending on postgraduate scholars and gives us solid data to make even better decisions in the future. It is a true compromise and one that protects our most at-risk students while we land on long-term sustainable solutions.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions? Representative Hack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a clarification. One, was there a fiscal impact study done on the impact to the state school fund if all districts across the state decided to utilize the fifth year? And secondly, if students choose not to graduate on time, because I know that, thank you for your work that you did, by the way, sounds like you guys did a lot. I know that there are several districts in our state that utilize the fifth year to give students the opportunity to receive a year of college credit, not because they necessarily don't graduate on time, but because they choose not to take one class so that they can become a fifth-year student to get the free college. Mm-hmm. My concern with that is that while I love and support the fact that our kids are getting a post-secondary education and going on to college, I don't want to see that on the backs of the state school fund. Mm-hmm. So I didn't hear you address that will no longer be allowed, that the only ones that would qualify are those who are in absolute need and are failing. I don't have an issue with
yes.
So can you clarify maybe that we're going to hear from you later that it is absolutely going to be written in stone that it is only for those that are failing and not meeting, and we're not going to let folks that just want,
yes,
not on the backs of the state school fund and taking away from other kids? Because if, let's say, Portland Public decides they're going to do this, what's going to be the fiscal impact to the state school fund?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative
Thank
Pack.
You.
Thank you. This was one of the largest concerns, aside from the state school funding, is who are the students that we're targeting. And the sideboards that have been placed into the draft bill, you will see, are very narrow and do target only those students that, one, have received the diploma, so they're not holding back. They have to be their credits have to be such that they can receive their standard diploma, go through the FAFSA, apply for any federal aid that they can possibly have. So what this becomes is kind of this catch-all for our most underrepresented, at-risk students that are not eligible for federal aid, that are going on and want to be able to go on to have college, that first-year college. It's narrowed the field so that not just holding back credit, those students are not eligible.
Can I ask a clarifying? Mm-hmm. So, thank you, Madam Chair. They don't qualify for financial aid. They've been given a standard diploma, not a modified diploma.
Correct.
So if they don't qualify for federal aid, then where's the need?
So, for instance, we have a student in Corvallis. I'll be pretty specific. Their freshman, sophomore year, really issues with family or on the streets. We pull them back in. Their GPA is much, much lower. We get them up to speed. They regain that hope. They're going to graduate. We get them over that bar, but their GPA is below a 2.5. They're not eligible for Oregon Promise. So that particular student would be one that would be eligible for the postgraduate scholar program for 1 year. So their GPA requirements may be below a 2.5 and would not be eligible for financial assistance. So that's one example. Students that perhaps come from homeless situations. There's a number of catch-all sidebars that are included in here that separate out the students that you're referring to that did not have their four-year diploma in hand. They may have been holding off. That completely narrows the field. So we're talking about a very targeted group of students.
Okay. It sounds like these are issues that when we have a hearing,
yeah,
we have definitely
exactly
really
interested
yes,
to see.
Yes,
yeah. I still not. Okay, thank you so
yes,
much.
Yes, you're welcome.
Thank you. Any other questions, Representative Wilson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, when we come back and actually talk about the bill, it will be really helpful to allay any abstractions here to give an example of a prototypical student here that's affected, so we can kind of better understand that.
Yeah, we hope when we get to that point to actually bring students to tell their stories so that you can actually hear the type of student at most risk that has that great hope to go on that needs the added supports. And I think that was what was so profound about the success of the fifth-year programs was the support provided by the high school and the community college that just didn't drop out from underneath the student.
Thank you.
Representative Reardon.
I'm sorry, I might have missed something here. So is the goal to get all of these students into college? Does that work?
No, the fifth-year programs are certification, CTE programs, license programs, so a lot of the students enter into the community college with a partnership, and they either go on to two-year success and then on to university four-year, or a lot of them exit out after the first year with their certifications and trade so that they have good paying wage, living wage jobs.
That's the part I wanted to hear.
Yes, exactly.
Thank you.
Okay. Anything else?
Okay, thank you very much.
Oh, don't sit down, Representative. We would like to hear from Representative Barbara Smith Warner.
That's where the direction we're going.
With a little explanation on LC question mark.
Oh. What is that?
Okay, so you want to explain what your concept is.
Good morning, colleagues. Thank you so much for giving me a few moments this morning to talk to you about a legislative concept. For the record, my name is Barbara Smith Warner, and I am the state representative for House District 45 in Northeast Portland, Maywood Park, and Park Rose. I'm sorry that I do not know the legislative concept number off the top of my head either, but I know, gotten around and either talked to or dropped off to your offices some information about this. Access to summer learning is the topic. Access to summer learning has been a priority for me since I was appointed to the legislature. So I've got two kids in public schools, and I've long thought that we send the craziest message to our kids, which is education is the most important thing that you do, but we only want you to do it for 9 months out of the year. And those 3 months off have a huge impact, as all of you know. We talk a lot about the achievement gap for low-income and minority kids in this state and everywhere. These kids aren't dumb. They are learning at the same rates as their peers during the school year, thanks to a lot of dedicated teachers. But research shows that up to 40% of that achievement gap can be attributed to the cumulative loss of learning that occurs in the summer months, the dreaded summer slide. Many kids from families living in poverty, families struggling with access to health care, child care, food, transportation, they're the same kids who do not have access to enriching activities in the summer months. These are kids that are not getting sent to camp or getting to do projects in the summer. They are having little to no exposure to academic things, even as simple as summer reading. Hopefully they're getting to some of the summer food sites that are out there. So after discussing a variety of piecemeal ways to approach this over about the last year and a half, I decided to work towards a summer learning policy advisory group that would elevate that with the hopes of elevating this discussion with the goal of making access to summer learning for every student a state priority. So what do we mean by access to summer learning? Is it year-round school? Is it safe recreation and skill building? Is it recovering credit hours for kids who have not passed through a course? Is it a chance to learn a new skill or become proficient in a new language? The answer is yes. All of these are valuable models for providing summer learning opportunities. And every community may have a different way of providing them, from the Boys and Girls Club of the Illinois Valley to the Tigard Library. In researching this, we found that while the solutions can and should be community-specific, the problem really is statewide. So rather than simply increasing funding for some programs in some communities while others fall further behind, we really want to prioritize access to summer learning for every student across the state and have that become a state priority. So the policy advisory group and its members, legislators, teachers, parents, Oregon Department of Education folks, Oregon State Library, community organizations, school boards, and administrators will seek to reframe education as a 12-month endeavor, to think broadly throughout the whole year about it. Our first priority is going to be to find out where are we right now. to establish who's doing what in summer learning across the state. Then we'll use those best practices to create a roadmap for how we get from where we are to where we want to be, a state that provides access to academically and personally enriching summer learning opportunities for every student across the state whose family wants or needs it. Thank you very much. You have the one pager on OLIS, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Hey, any questions? Hey, thank you, Representative.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, now what's the section? So this is where we close the informational hearing on possible education topics for the upcoming session and open up an informational meeting on charter school funding. We have two people from ODE and... And part of this is one thing we didn't deal with in the regular session was just it's where our information as to how charter schools are funded in the state of Oregon.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Members of the committee. I'm Kate Pattison. I'm the charter school specialist at the Oregon Department of Education.
And my name is Michael Elliott, state school fund coordinator at the Oregon Department of Education.
Okay. All right, so I'm going to start out this morning. We have a little bit of an overview of what charter schools are and how they fit into the system, and then we'll get into the specifics of funding. So what is a public charter school? A public charter school is an elementary or secondary school. They're comprehensive schools, and they're established through a contract with a sponsor. In Oregon, that's typically a school district. Charter schools are public schools of choice where students get to opt in. They choose to apply to the public school. They're considered component schools of a district. They're authorized by and accountable to a sponsor. So through that contract, it defines what the charter school is responsible for achieving, and then that accountability. They continue to exist through a renewal process where the charter school's performance is evaluated. They must comply with federal law, and they're bound to most education laws in the state, but not all. They have some flexibility. So on this map, you can see the distribution of public charter schools in the state right now. Obviously, there's a big concentration in the metro area there, but they are all over the state, and we do have a lot of rural charter schools, which is one of the things that kind of sets Oregon apart from the national charter school piece. A lot of national charter schools are very urban and larger. Charter schools in Oregon are smaller, typically, and in rural communities. So this year we have 126 public charter schools in Oregon. There are 77 districts that are sponsoring charter schools. We have 18 single school district charter schools. So that's where it's a school district with one school, and that one school is a public charter school. There are 13 virtual public charter schools, and most of those 13 virtual charter schools serve students statewide. There are four public charter schools that are sponsored by the State Board of Education. Last school year, we had almost 30,000 students, public students, enrolled in public charter schools, and that equates to about 5.5% of the students enrolled in public schools in Oregon. You can see here the demographics. This is from last year, the most current data we have. The green represents non-charter public school students, and the blue is charter schools. This trend that you see here where there are more white students and a little bit less diversity in public charter schools has been consistent over their operating existence. So how are public charter schools funded? In Oregon, we have the charter school statute, and it says that a charter school must contractually establish the payment in their contract. So the terms of payment are established in their contract. And for district-sponsored charter schools, they must receive at least a minimum of 80% of the charter rate for K-8 students and at least 95% of the charter rate for 9-12 students. For those schools sponsored by the State Board of Education, we also have the option of schools sponsored by higher ed, but there are no current charter schools sponsored by higher ed institutions. The percent is a little different. For K-8 students, it's at least 90%, and for 9-12 students, it's 95%. So the payment is a negotiated percentage, and it's of the charter rate. And so we have Michael Elliott, who is the expert on state school funding, and he will be able to explain that.
So as you can see, the question becomes, what is the charter rate? And the charter rate is a district's general purpose grant divided by the district's current year ADMW, or average daily membership weighted. And that gives us the charter rate. So what's the general purpose grant? That leads to the next question. And in a very brief overview of the general purpose grant, it is the total amount of funding, which in the state school fund formula accounts for local revenue and is the state revenue provided in the state school fund by the legislature, minus what I'm generally calling disbursements. This includes subgrants like the high cost disability grant. It includes like the small high school grant, transportation grant. And it also includes various programs sponsored by the state school fund, including free lunch subsidy, the Oregon School for the Deaf gets a payment from the state school fund, long-term care and treatment, and other types of programs. So when you take those disbursements off and you divide by the total statewide extended ADMW, and that briefly then multiplied by the district extended ADMW gives the district's general purpose grant. Now, I will admit that I'm not including teacher experience to just give you a basic thing, because teacher experience is part of this formula. It will change that a little bit, but at a very high level, we're looking at all the revenue, take out the disbursements, divide by the total statewide extended ADMW, and then multiply that number, which is your dollars per weight, by the district's extended ADMW. What is extended ADMW? Extended ADMW is the greater of this year's ADMW, average daily membership weighted, or last year's ADMW. This was set into the formula to provide help for those districts experiencing declining enrollment. As districts are budgeting, they're usually budgeting a year or two out, they're forecasting, and so it becomes difficult to forecast your declining enrollment, and extended ADMW gives them a floor to budget to say, okay, you know how much you're going to get because the previous year's ADMW will be what you can budget to, and it really helps those districts. So what is ADMW? As I've said, average daily membership weighted. It's how we count students for the state school fund. We are in a weighted student formula, which means that all students coming in do not all require the same amount of cost to educate. Students needing special education services, students needing EL services, students in poverty have been determined to need, they take additional costs, so the district receives additional resources to help provide for those students. Here are the weights involved in the ADMW. The first is the biggest. It's average daily membership resident. The easiest way to think of this is 1 plus 1 plus 1 equals 1. One student attending one school for one school year equals one ADMR. It's the only time in math that that works. I love it. Students eligible for special education get an additional weight. So if you have a student that needs some special education services, they count for two weights. But that is capped at 11% of the district's ADMR, and there is a cap waiver calculation that goes into that as well. ESL or ELL, there is an additional half weight for every student receiving services from a qualifying program. There's no cap to this. Poverty, this is based on U.S. Census Bureau data, and it is a district estimate about how much poverty is in that district, and so the district receives additional weights based on that U.S. Census Bureau data. Pregnant and parenting, again, so long as the district is providing a qualifying program and providing services to these students so they have a chance to graduate, the district will receive an additional weight for those students. The remote small elementary correction, this and the small high school correction, both recognize that our rural schools are still schools. They're still bricks and mortar. They still need electricity. They still need heat, especially in some of the mountainous areas. It gets really cold. And so this provides additional weights when the number of students may not be enough to actually fund the running and operation of the school. And those are also formulas as well. Additional quarter weight for neglected, delinquent, and foster students. These are different categories. Information provided us from Department of Human Services. And then we do have one Union High School district. This is down in Harney County. It's Crane Union High School. It is the entire school district is only a high school, and it services, I believe, six or seven districts that are only elementary school districts. So the elementary school districts get a little bit less weight, and the high school gets a little bit more weight per student. So that's your average daily membership weighted. Those numbers are added. A district compares the extent the previous year's ADMW with the current year, gets the greater of those two, and then gets that funding based on the dollars per weight. So again, it's good to remember the flow of the funding. It starts off with state and local revenue. Federal funds are included. It flows to the district. State school fund payments are made to the district. They are not made to a charter school. The district then negotiates a charter school contract and either does the minimum percentages of the charter rate based on current ADMW or does percentages that are higher than that. And then the school district then distributes money to the charter school for the charter school's funding purposes. If you have addition, you know, there are additional resources. The ORS 338.155 talks about funding for charter schools as well as a couple other statutes there. 157 talks about how charter school weights are calculated in terms of poverty. And then 165 talks about special education students. So in a charter school, the underlying statutory theory is that the district will provide the special education services to special education students attending a charter school. Therefore, the district would keep the additional resources to provide those services, and the charter school would get the general education weight. Districts and charter schools can change that. If a charter school wants to have a program that helps a certain type of special education student and provide those services, they can negotiate with the district such that the district would then give more resources to the charter school. The students for poverty in a charter, those weights, it's the same as the district percentage. So the district has a 30% poverty rate, then the charter school would be assumed to have that same poverty percentage. So if the charter school had 200 students, it would be assumed that they would get 60 weights or 60 students, and then that would be a times a quarter weight, which would be additional 15 weights. Why that matters is because the charter funding is 80% of the just general purpose grant, 80% of the charter rate times a charter school's weights. So that's why you have to account for if the charter school is providing EL services, pregnant and parenting services, these types of services where the charter school is providing services and therefore would get the weight for those students. So it wouldn't just be the strict student count of the charter school, it'd be what additional services they're providing.
Right. So I was going to say when you were talking about all of the weights, I was referencing a lot of districts, but those weights then would apply to the charter schools if they're offering an approved program, for example, with the ESL, ELL students, they would then be able to claim those weights as well.
And then finally, the if you want some really light reading, ORS 327013 spells out the state school fund formula. It's riveting, I assure you. And then that's really the basics of charter school funding. So if you have any questions.
Okay. Any questions? Representative Paluso.
I'm just curious. Do we cap the number of charter schools we can have in the state?
Madam Chair, Representative Paluso, no. The state law does not have a cap on the number of charter schools in Oregon.
And then not to be super simplistic, but I was early on when charter schools came to us, I was told that there a piece of a criteria was that the charter school needed to provide something that our public school did not in order to be a charter school. Is that anywhere near accurate?
Madam Chair, Representative, the law does talk about legislative intent and does list, I believe it's 9 kind of goals of a charter school legislation that charter schools would do, and some of that is increase educational innovation, increase achievement, provide some dissemination of best practice, and then also create small learning environments. There isn't necessarily a requirement that the charter school must be different, but that is also up to the proposal of a charter school and how a district evaluates the charter school proposal.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions? Representative Reardon.
Well, thank you for coming in. This is always a good review of the formula. Are charter school students held to the same standards and have to meet the same testing requirements as other students? Or?
Madam Chair, Representative Reardon, charter schools, that is one of the pieces of state law that does apply to public charter schools. They are held to Oregon state education standards, so that would be the Common Core and any other state content standards there are, as well as the state assessment system. So they do participate and are required to participate in Smarter Balanced or OAKS, ELPA, any of the state assessments.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would only guess that there's a lot of quibbling about the formula, I would expect. So are changes to the formula established through changes in state law, state statute, or administrative rule, or at district level?
Madam Chair, Representative Wilson, I think what are you referring to, the percentages, the minimum percentages for charter schools, or the overall funding formula?
I'm really not sure how to answer that. You know, when I look at the formula and see all the different weightings and issues like that, again, is that changed by rule?
Chair Doherty, Representative Wilson, the percentages of the charter rate are set in statute as well as all of the weights. They are also set in statute. So it would be a legislative choice to change weights, how they're calculated, and how the charter schools are funded.
Thank you. Just a brief follow-up. How do you develop a single school district that is a charter? Was there another school there beforehand, before it became a charter, or what? I'm kind of thinking like Crane. It looked like there was one out in Christmas Valley or something like that.
Chair, Representative Wilson, single school districts are allowed to convert their only school to become a charter school. Hmm. And so that has happened since we've had charter school legislation for a variety of reasons. And I think a lot of that initially happened to open district boundaries, in a sense, before there was open enrollment. You had, it became a school of choice, students from any district could attend the school of choice. Okay. Districts that have multiple schools cannot have all of their schools be public charter schools, but single school districts can convert their one school to become a charter school.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Madam Chair. You did not point out the number of elementary schools, middle schools, and high schools that are charter, and I'm not talking about the virtual ones. What is the percentage? Do you have any sense of the numbers there?
Madam Chair, Representative Frederick, I don't have that number right off. I could get back to you with that. I can tell you that there are more elementary students and more charter schools serving elementary grades than high school secondary grades.
Thank you.
Okay, if you want to get that to Representative Frederick. Any other questions? Representative Hack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious on so 80% of the ADMW, the most that a school district can give to a charter, was it 80%? Is that right?
Madam Chair, Representative Hack, no, that's the minimum. That's the minimum. And it's the 80% of the district's general, of the charter rate. So if the charter rate is $7,000, it would be $5,600 times the amount of weights in the charter school.
And the weights are the same. ADMW is ADMW. That doesn't change, right? So the kids that go to the charter out of that district are calculated the same ADMW.
Madam Chair, Representative Hack, generally, yes. There are some, for example, if a charter school does not offer any EL services and the district then provides those services, then the charter wouldn't get the EL weights. But the same calculations happen, yes. So an EL student in a charter school is the same as an EL student in a regular school for purposes of weighting.
Okay, one more. Thank you. So do we know the percentages of charter schools that get the minimum? Do we have a breakdown of you know, on average, charter schools are receiving X percentage of the ADM, and districts are holding back, say, on average, 5% of that, or?
Madam Chair, Representative Hack, we don't have that exactly. I can tell you that most charter schools are receiving minimums. There are some that have negotiated higher rates of the percent, but that would require, we don't collect that out of the charter contracts, but it's in all the charter contracts.
And do we know what the reasoning is behind the districts holding back those dollars? Is there a reason why they don't give them the full amount of money that they would get normally for the kids? Is there a reason why the outside of, I get if they're providing a service to the kids like the EL, you know, some of the things like special ed and those kinds of things, absolutely, I get that. But outside of that, is there a reason? Is there an administrative thing? Is there something that we don't, I mean, I know there's lots of costs related, but.
Right. Madam Chair, Representative Hack, the law allows them to use any funds withheld for any purpose or for serving the charter school, and there are a variety of reasons. And so some
no
of that
accountability,
is, I mean, there is administrative function and cost associated with authorizing a charter school and doing the accountability to oversee sponsors, authorizers are required to do an annual site visit and then evaluate the school's performance on a regular basis. So there is some cost, and so most districts will say that they're associating that holdback with those functions. But it's varied across the state.
Do they give a breakdown of that? Like, do they give that to ODE to say, this is what we did for the charter, this is the breakdown of why we withheld these funds, and this kind of a checks and balances with that?
No, Madam Chair, Representative Hack, we don't collect that information.
Okay, thank you. Okay.
Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This was a major conversation that we've been having regarding this, and we had a very interesting meeting yesterday on these specific issues that you were just bringing up. And I want to bring up again the fact that there is a difference in terms of the cost for an elementary school student, a middle school student, and a high school student, and that the costs and how that is associated not so much with the ADMW, because that is a general number and essentially an average number that's going to a district. I think one of the key things that has concerned me for quite some time is that we do not have money following the kid. It is it's a different, the formula is set up in a different way. Although it is a lot of, it's easier to say the money follows the kid. In fact, the money is set up in a different way to go to a district. And the costs are different in terms of an elementary school student and a high school student. I think we need to keep that in mind as we're looking at the charters, as we're looking at what goes on generally. So I just wanted to make that point. It's something that I think is important. Thank you.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, thank you very much. Okay, with that, our closing informational meeting on charter school funding, and kind of reopen an informational meeting on committee LC presentations. And Representative McLean.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I wanted to let you know that I wasn't sure how this was handled today, so I do have a one-pager that I've given to Richard, and he will put it on OLIS. And if you want one now, I also have ones that you can have at the dais. And
it's on OLIS,
sorry. It's on OLIS already. So the bill draft that I'm going to be talking about today is one of my two bills, and it's LC21, and it's a study of virtual public charter schools. And as you can tell from the last presentation, there's a very complicated system of how students are paid for in our schools in the state of Oregon. And one of the elements that I'm asked over and over again is, what's the accountability for how the dollars are spent in any school, whether it be a public school, brick and mortar, whether it is a charter school, or whether it is a virtual charter school. And so this particular LC is trying to address this information question to provide clarity of how we get accountability for the dollars that we give to the different schools. This particular study in the LC21 is going to concentrate on the virtual schools, because there seems to be more, I guess I would say, flexibility with what they're required to do, and also some of the terminology, like the difference between you must have a plan or you're required to do. As I looked at the statutes over the last 6 months in the interim, was very unclear and very difficult to explain to people that were asking, how do you get accountability for the dollars spent in these different schools? And so LC21, and I'm not going to be making the presentation, this is just an introduction, is basically going to consist of a study that would be done by the Department of Ed. I think it's very important that the study is done by someone that's not a charter school or a public school advocate, but someone who's just looking with neutral eyes at how we get accountability for the money spent in these schools. Also, it's going to be looking at, as was indicated by one of the last speakers, the district host is supposed to be doing a review or an evaluation of how they're doing, performing, just as we have public school boards that actually look at our school budgets and look at how our school is doing in a particular district. And as she indicated, it's very different all around the state. And part of that has to do with the language, the difference between they must have a plan that shows that they're dealing with these 7 or 8 tenants, or it's a requirement. And so this plan does address looking at that evaluation of, are they doing the job? Because no matter if these students are in a public school, if they're in a charter school, or if they're in a virtual charter school, as a state of Oregon, we're saying that they're getting the very best possible education, and that those dollars are being spent to provide for those students no matter where they're going to school. And then finally, something that came up in the last 6 or 7 months in the state of Washington, they declared charter schools not public schools, so they couldn't get public dollars. And I thought, oh my gosh, there's another place for people to go to court. And so in this particular LC21, I want to make sure that our virtual charter schools have what we call electable boards, because if it's an appointed board versus being an elected board, the courts in the state of Washington said it's not a public school. It doesn't have public review. And so the virtual charter schools can decide how they elect them. It's supposed to be their patrons, and it's their process. But I think you want to make sure you're electable so that you can be considered a public school so you can receive public dollars. So I'm just simply trying to clear up ambiguity around language that's different between the schools, and also how we as a state or state legislature can guarantee that we're looking for the same kind of accountability for all types of schools in the state of Oregon. So there'll be a lot of more specifics, and we'll get, I believe those bills are going up on the 19th, so the language is out there for everybody to look at. I've talked to some
representatives. May not be posted till a couple of days
after that. The 19th, right?
That's our deadline to turn them in.
Oh, okay. So anyway, I'll get copies of them and have them in my office, but then it'll also be online to look at it. But that's my introduction, and I'm happy to answer any questions, but I'm not going to be speaking for or against. I'm just giving information.
Okay, thank you. Any questions of Representative?
Thank you.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll do some research on this, but for point of clarification, who declared in Washington that charter schools were not public schools, or is that a conversation?
That was a court.
The Supreme Court.
The court did. Oh. And so it was real important for us not, I think, to inherit a problem like that.
Okay. Thank you.
And I think one of the differences in Washington State, it is a new concept of charter schools until I have not been in the state of Washington, and so that's when the clarification came up. Okay, any other questions? Okay. Thank you, Representative. Okay, with that, I will close the informational meeting on LC presentations and open up an informational meeting on kindergarten assessment. And again, as they're coming up, this was one of the things that we've talked about, assessments and so on, and they've always, had assessments of the kinders and thought maybe you might want some information as to what they do. Other than, can you get on the bus?
Chair Doherty, committee. For the record, my name is David Mandel, and I'm the Policy and Research Director for the Early Learning Division, Oregon Department of Education. I'm pleased to be joined today by my colleague, Derek Brown, Assistant Superintendent, Office of Learning in the Department of Education, to talk about Oregon's kindergarten assessment, its purpose, how it's being used, and the work that's underway to make it an even more powerful support for learning. Not only is this, I think, an important topic, but having the two of us up here together models work that's currently underway to bring early learning more closely together with the world of K through 12, and the kindergarten assessment is a really important part of that work. So I'm really pleased to have this chance to demonstrate that collaboration. I'd like to begin today talking about the purpose of Oregon's kindergarten assessment. It's to provide local and statewide information about the strengths and areas for growth in developmental and academic skills of Oregon's youngest students, and to provide a consistent statewide tool for identifying systemic opportunity gaps and for measuring progress over time. This slide would be much longer and much more crowded if we listed all of the things that the kindergarten assessment is not about. But I will call out two of those knots that I think are really important. It's not about determining whether a child is ready for kindergarten. If a child is 5, it's the obligation of the schools to be ready for that child. And it's not about making high-stake judgments about programs or teachers. After Derek talks a little bit about what's in the current kindergarten assessment and shares with you some of the data, I'll go back and talk a little bit about some of the ways that the kindergarten assessment is being currently used.
Thank you, David. Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, my name is Derek Brown. I'm the Assistant Superintendent for Assessment and Accountability at the Oregon Department of Education. I'm going to spend just a couple of slides talking a little bit about sort of the construction of the kindergarten assessment and some results from the 2014-15 school year.
And can I ask David one question really quick? This is not a new concept. We've been assessing kindergartners, kinders for a long time.
Yes. Yeah, Madam Chair, yes, that's correct. So this slide is going to describe to you a little bit about how the kindergarten assessment is organized. And you can see there really are three different domains, if you will. You'll see the early literacy domain, where we learn information about a student's ability to identify letter names and sounds. We have an early math domain, and I'll talk a little bit more in detail about these as we look at some of the data. And then there's also a component we refer to as approaches to learning, where we're taking a look at a student's ability to self-regulate and interpersonal skills. Go ahead and go to the next slide. So the next handful of slides, I'll go through them fairly quickly for you, but these are data that came from the 2014-15 administration of the kindergarten assessment, which is not this last fall, but the fall before that. We'll be releasing 2015-16 administration data on February 8th, so that's coming up very soon. The slide in front of you is the early math data. I would say that these results are fairly consistent with what we saw during the first year of administration, which would have been the one before the one you're seeing right here. And you can see what we would refer to as a kind of a fairly normal-looking bell curve or distribution. Your y-axis along the left is kind of the frequency by thousands of students. With the early math, we've got about 16 questions that get into trying to understand a little bit more about a student's ability to identify relationships and operations, so basic addition and subtraction, things like that. Also concepts and quantities, so thinking about groupings of numbers and a student's ability to understand kind of the ordinal properties of math, so ranking and things like that, size, so to speak. So this shows you the number of correct responses according to the frequencies of students. And again, a fairly normal distribution there. If we go to the next slide, letter names, which is exactly what you would think it is, a student's ability to identify a letter. So students are presented with what we call a grid. So that's previously a 10 by 10 grid of randomized upper and lowercase letters, and students are given a minute to go through and identify as many of those as they can. And the person that's administering the test is simply recording as they go. So a student is presented that information and they're able to engage with it for about 60 seconds and then move on to the next thing. You can see here that the distribution looks a little bit different. We would characterize this by saying most students were able to produce some correct letter names, but it looks a little different than it did on the math component. Going to the next slide, letter sounds. Again, a student's ability to identify a letter sound. And again, this one looks a little bit more like the letter names. Students have a little bit more difficulty with this particular component of the kindergarten assessment. Let's go ahead and go to the next pieces. Within approaches to learning, self-regulation, and interpersonal skills, this particular domain is observed by the teacher, and then the teacher answers 15 questions for each student, 10 for the self-regulation and 5 for the interpersonal skills.
And what are examples of like questions they would ask on this?
Yeah, so it's a Likert scale observing behavior, and with self-regulation, it would be questions along the lines of a student's ability to follow directions, to be at their table, for example, to stay on task. And things of that nature. And again, the Likert scale and the questions are really just the degree to which they're observing that behavior, meaning never, rarely, sometimes, frequently, or always is how we would differentiate. And you can see when you look at the histogram where you see those spikes at 3, 4, and 5 along the way. And then finally, on the interpersonal skills, a teacher's observation of a student's ability to work well with their neighbors and with their peers and kind of the social component, if you will. Okay.
And we want to spend a little bit of time today just talking about how the kindergarten assessment is being currently used. But before, the kindergarten assessment offers us a snapshot in time as children are entering kindergarten. And part of that reason that that snapshot at that particular moment is so important is it's the first time we actually know where children are. So, you know, one of the interesting, you know, so early childhood is very different than K through 12 in that it's all, you know, all voluntary, and our opportunities to connect with families and children before they enter to school, you know, really happen in a very different kind of way. So the kindergarten assessment is really our first opportunity to have population-level data about how our children are doing, at least with for some of those key skills that we know are related to later academic success. And because of that, it's already become a really important tool for us and particularly our Early Learning Hub partners to help think about where to direct resources. So, for instance, I know that Early Learning Hub, Inc. and Marion and Polk used that kind of data when thinking about what elementary school catchments to direct some of its kindergarten partnership and innovation funds, you know, just as an example of that. And we also know that it's already, because of that, it's become a really important tool for schools and early childhood providers to really start working together and think about what some of those strengths that children and families are bringing to communities and how to build on and deepen those strengths. We do know that there's more work to do to make this a valuable tool for kindergarten teachers in the classroom, and that's something that we recognize. And Derek will share with you some of the changes ahead that we think are going to take us in the right direction around that. But I also wanted to share with you one just concrete example of how communities are using the kindergarten assessment to track the impact of some of their investments. And this slide I'm showing you is from a summer transition program in Eastern Oregon, primarily Ontario, Vale, Nissa, and Baker. The majority of the 92 children who participate in this program are living in poverty and are English language learners. And this particular data focuses on 54 participants who are Hispanic. And this was a sort of a summer jumpstart program working with kids before they entered kindergarten. And they were able to, when the children who participated in this program entered into kindergarten, compare the data in the community with children who didn't participate in statewide data. And they were able to really see some really important impacts of this work that they were able to do over the summer that they may not have been able to actually be able to see and document without the kindergarten assessment. So I just wanted to share with this you as an example of some of the ways that communities are currently using this data. And again, this was also a local community investment that was made in Eastern Oregon using kindergarten partnership and innovation funds.
Yeah, thank you. As David mentioned, we know that there's plenty of work to do to continue to improve the measure, and we're very excited about those opportunities. He also mentioned that this has been very much a cross-agency effort. This last fall was the third year of administration of this particular kindergarten assessment, and there have been adjustments, improvement across those first two or three years for sure. Moving forward, the improvements, this slide really just sort of captures in a broad way the areas that we know we need to be focusing on very smartly as we work to improve the measure. So thinking about how it's implemented and how it's administered, I'll give you some more concrete examples of that in just a moment. Thinking about the cultural responsivity of the test and how it helps us understand opportunity gaps for communities of color and emerging bilingual students. And then finally, again, with David's last example, thinking about how we can use this to better provide resources, tools, and other supports to communities. One really important group that we work with as part of this effort is a group called the Kindergarten Assessment Advisory. And this is a slide just meant to give you some contextualization about who makes up this group and how they bring a variety of really powerful perspectives and expertise to the table when we're thinking about how do we make this the most useful tool that it can be. So you can see early learning providers obviously are very important in this conversation, kindergarten teachers, administrators, and so on and so forth. I won't rattle them all off. There's also a strong footprint here from higher ed relative to the research component. We know there's a lot of research in this area, and we want to be dialed into it as we move forward so that we're really aligning this work with what the research is telling us. The last slide goes into a few more concrete examples of ways that we're working cross-agency, listening to educators, and paying attention to the research in terms of making some of these improvements. The kindergarten assessment has traditionally been what we refer to as a secure assessment, and we've heard loud and clear from practitioners in the field and others that creating a secure assessment, you create certain restrictions in terms of how folks can use the data, how quickly they get the data, and a number of other things. So we worked with the advisory panel and the core team that oversees it, and one shift moving forward will be to change the nature of the assessment to be a non-secure. That'll really help, I think, folks in the field. Better aligning the assessment with the early learning standards, which really come from the early learning standards of the Head Start program. Those standards have changed a little bit over time, and the kindergarten assessment is taking a look at those adjustments and making sure that we continue to refine the alignment of the test to those standards. As part of that work, we're also thinking about the Common Core standards and making sure that the assessment aligns in appropriate ways to that assessment. There were a couple of examples listed, other examples listed there. One thing that we'll be doing moving forward is removing the timing component for those literacy measures. That'll be, we believe, an improvement to the assessment. There are other domains that we think are worthwhile to take a look at as we review the literature and we take a look at what other states are doing. So we're thinking about things along the lines of vocabulary measures and things like that. Also taking a very good look at the research and talking to experts about how we can improve the Spanish language and literacy measures. And there are lots of best practices out there, so we just want to incorporate those to the best of our ability. And then finally, the last bullet is providing more interpretive guidance to help practitioners better understand the results. We have been a bit cautious, I would say, over the course of the first couple of years, given that it's a new assessment and given that it has been adjusted a little bit over the first couple of years to interpret it in very deep ways. But now we have 3 years of baseline data, and so we're endeavoring to start to create the kinds of interpretive materials and guidance that we think would really help educators as they receive these results and think about program and support.
Okay, questions? Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We need to have a longer conversation, but because I will tell you that I get a lot of kindergarten. I have a lot of kindergarten teachers for some reason in my district, and they show up at my town hall, and they talk about this. The key, I think you're speaking to a little bit there. They have not been told that this is not high stakes assessment of students. Or teachers. They have been told that exactly the opposite, that in fact the implementation is a huge issue for them because they've been told that this is going to determine a number of things related to their, not only to the teacher's job, but to the kids themselves, and that they will be identified from then on as having issues and basically have a bright star on them that they need to watch for. And the other issue, of course, is the time getting ready for the assessment. In many cases, though, these teachers talk with me from different districts, by the way. This is not just Portland District. This is Reynolds. This is Oregon City, David Douglas, and several other districts. So they come to me to tell me that they are very concerned about that. And the basic issue that they are concerned about is the lack of understanding the developmental processes that are involved with kindergartners, that they are not coming in all in one, one particular kind of kid, and that they all are supposed to know these things. The bell curve on the math didn't surprise me. The concern that I have is some of the other ones that are specific to self-regulation and interpersonal skills. It is, in fact, expected that a kindergartner is going to have a wide range of approaches there, and that this is that we should not be cookie-cuttering them. So I want to have some longer conversation with you about that.
Madam Chair, Representative Frederick, thank you very much for that. I think that David and I and others that we partner with, we can all collectively do more work and a better job of communicating what the purpose of the assessment is, what the value of the assessment is. And so it's very good for us to receive that feedback, and we can find more ways to engage with folks locally and have that conversation. I do want to respond to one other comment to say that, again, as David pointed out, the purpose of the assessment is not to pigeonhole students in any way, shape, or form. It's just designed to give us an idea about where students are on that trajectory as they're entering, so that services and interventions and supports can be provided appropriately, moving students forward.
Madam Chair, Representative Frederick, one thing I did want to add is one of the things that's been really interesting in some of the opportunities I've had to present some of those slides that Derek shared with you earlier is that I think one of the things that the kindergarten assessment allows us to do is to actually demonstrate to other audiences something that kindergarten teachers know, that kids are coming in with really a very wide range of skills and abilities. And, you know, that's also one of the elements that we have to support kindergarten teachers in that reality. And I found those slides actually very useful in helping to explain that and demonstrate that to other audiences.
Just one quick follow-up, if you don't mind. I will stress again, my concern is that the implementation is not consistent across the state, and certainly not even consistent in Multnomah County. So I would encourage you to have that conversation with the administrators that you're seeing, because what I'm hearing from those folks, from the teachers, and the parents, quite frankly, who are also in the classroom, is that there is an expectation of high stakes, and that the kids are labeled from then on as being an issue, a problem, because they aren't at a particular self-regulatory level, or they don't know their letters at this point, and they're supposed to know their letters. That's how it's put to them. They're supposed to know their letters right now, and they don't. And so they get labeled. This is the implementation issue, as much as you might be seeing it from the state level. The implementation issue in the classroom is a different story.
Yeah. Well, and it varies from district to district,
because
my Tiger Tualatin School District goes through, and they don't have school the first week because they are meeting with parents and the kids, and they're doing all of these kind of things, and they're doing the assessments, and they're doing all of this kind of stuff. And the kinder teachers that I've talked to say that they use this so they can go through and make sure they'll, you know, help the kids. So again, it's districts giving the educators the time to also work with parents, which is a really good thing.
Right. Well, it just underscores the importance of, you know, good communications and and helping the teacher be successful and good professional development. So just really love this presentation. Could you kind of paint a picture for me, though? It's test day and kindergarten, and what's going on? What's it look like?
Madam Chair, Representative Reardon, I think it probably varies a little bit from one district to the next, depending on the size of the district and how they've chosen to organize those testing events, if you will. I have a first grader and a third grader, so I have recent experience with kids going through this process as well. As Madam Chair mentioned, I think kindergarten educators have been going through a process similar to this for many, many, many years. We've had a state-level kindergarten assessment now for 3 years, and we're about one of 40 states that do that. To answer your question directly, there's a person who administers the test to a student, if you will. It takes about 15 minutes, so a student's going to sit down, and they're going to have an opportunity to go through those letter names and letter sounds. Grids, if you will, about a minute each.
One on one.
Okay. That's correct. And the administrator is doing all the recording, so a student isn't being asked to write anything down or anything like that. They're just verbalizing their responses. Then they have another opportunity to go through the math component again, 15 or 16 questions or so. Again, the test administrator is recording while the student is taking a look, and the test administrators are always also reading the question or the prompt, if you will, and then the student's engaging, and then the person administrator is recording. The approaches to learning pieces, the self-regulation, interpersonal skills, that's an observation over the next couple of weeks.
Sure.
So
sure.
The teacher comes back to that later on after they've had a chance to really kind of observe, you know, classroom activities and things like that, and then they provide that information, and then they submit all of that to us at one time.
Just one. And then that test administrator is not the teacher.
It Probably normally is, although I've spoken with enough districts to know that sometimes they've come up with other logistical solutions where they might bring in other folks to help, as Madam Chair mentioned, depending on, you know, the number of students and the number of resources that are available, they might have to set up another way to do it. So it doesn't have to be the teacher, but I think in some cases, probably in many of our small schools, it is the teacher.
Okay.
Other size schools and other size districts, they might have a different approach to it.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Ack.
I think it's more of a statement. Thank you, Madam Chair. To me, this is just makes it more obvious and evident that we have got to stay dedicated to making sure that every child enters school ready to learn and stay invested in that, because to me, that's really where we've got to stay focused. And we've thrown dollars at that in the past, and then we pull back from it, and we say we're going to be dedicated, and then we change our mind. To me, it's just clear that we have got to stay dedicated to that and working with our hubs and making sure we're working with preschools and connecting preschools with kindergarten teachers and bringing all those folks together so that we're working cohesively to make sure that these kids enter school absolutely ready to learn. Mm-hmm. So thank you for your presentation. I appreciate the work that you're doing.
Yeah, no, if I had a magic wand, every child would have Head Start.
Yeah, so, no kidding.
Yeah, sure.
Agreed.
Absolutely. Okay, any other questions? Okay, thank you very much for the presentation.
Thank you.
Okay, with that, I close the informational meeting on kindergarten assessment, and open up an informational meeting on House Bill 68. A little dyslexia there. 68 from 2015 is the final report.
Thank you very much, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Peter Tromba, and I'm the Policy and Research Director at the Chief Education Office. And I'll be giving a brief report on the work of the committee for House Bill 2968. And then after that update, Representative Wisnant will be, who's a co-sponsor of the legislation that created this work group, will be providing some additional comments. And we're not projecting. Oh, there we are. So first off, just to review what the work group was asked to do, this came out of the last session. And as you'd see in the bill, the work group, and you'll see in the next slide too, had a broad range of constituents that need to be represented. So in order to get a large group together in a short amount of time with a charge like this was a lot of work. And the ultimate charge of the group is to produce a report, which was forwarded over here in November, and you have as part of the documents with this presentation related to educational achievements of students from families in poverty. And the work group was asked to consider federal, state, and local resources, state poverty weight within the state school fund, and also other funding and financial barriers. And then the regroup had the option of being able to consider recommendations for legislation. The membership was huge. We had 25-ish people at our meetings, long, day-long meetings, because there was a lot of information in terms of background for everybody to get. Many of the stakeholders knew the poverty weight and things like that backwards and forwards, just like we just heard here with that long, long list. Mm-hmm. And some didn't know that we had a weighted school fund formula at all, so there was a lot of background information. We tried to make sure that we had balance in race and ethnicity, rural and urban representation. We had explicitly asked for and then received representation from a federally recognized tribal government. It was multi-sector, even among the state agencies. We had other sectors beyond education. We had public and community-based organizations, and some of those community-based organizations were culturally specific organizations. So, we included this slide. Really, this was the introductory remarks of our acting chief education officer, Lindsay Capps, to just kick it off, and this was substantiated throughout the meeting. This is a big deal that we talk about this. On average, students who are navigating poverty are performing lower than their more advantaged peers on all kinds of assessments, not just high-stakes assessments like OSAT, but things like attendance, graduation rates, pretty much any way you'd stack up student achievement. Certain student groups aren't performing at the same level. And something that's maybe most interesting is the wrong thing, but it's really good to think about and illustrate. Even among students in 10th grade in Oregon who score at the OSAT, Oregon State Assessment level, at about the same level as their more advantaged peers, graduate at lower rates. So they've overcome barriers, navigated these things, their families have gotten all the way to 10th grade. And something stops even in those couple years. Maybe it's employment, maybe it's economic, who knows? We don't have the case studies or anything to prove exactly what's going on. But these effects for students who are navigating poverty continue, and obviously past high school when they make their post-secondary choices. So what were our findings? Well, first off, with respect to poverty, we had lots of great testimony, lots of great members from around the state. And one thing that was really, really clear is that we need to have good lenses or good structures to think about poverty. And with respect to three concepts I'm here, they're interrelated, and we talked about them as a group and presented a lot of information to the group about, first of all, place. In Oregon, the conversation about poverty differs depending on where you live. And rural-urban is one way to think of it, but there's a lot of different rural Oregons, and then there's one big urban Oregon and a lot of smaller ones. So it's not just rural-urban, but there's differences, and rural areas have more students and families navigating poverty, period. And the research actually shows that there's some kind of rural effect in Oregon that is we actually haven't quantified or understand exactly why it's there. It may be just how distances spread out social services so much that there's just extra problems in rural areas for folks who are navigating poverty. Secondly, students of color are more likely to be navigating poverty in Oregon and across the country, and I'm going to provide a slide on that in a second that I've shared in lots of public meetings across the state since July, and it's really good to look at and think about. And then finally, in terms of rural and urban, the way they look a little different is in rural areas, poverty is most intense. So very, very extremely low income is more common in rural. And in with regard to families of color, you've got more of the intergenerational character to that situation. We looked at lots of data in the group. We looked at a graph like this for every county in Oregon. We looked at special education and poverty, lots and lots of different things. All of it's, and I brought my notebook with me as just a reminder to me to refer it to all of you that there's a lot of data that you're just not even going to hear about from me, but that's in these reports in your information and on the web. But this is a slide we'd like to show because it tells you how complex this story is when you try to implement things like this at the district level that would combat poverty. The blue in this slide and the red in this slide are two different ways of looking at the combination of race, ethnicity, and poverty in Oregon with our most up-to-date data, and this is family data 2009-2013. It's on the DAS website. The red line represents if we had all of the students and families in poverty in Oregon, how are they distributed by race and ethnicity? And what you see is all the way on the right-hand side, if we looked at all of the students in poverty in Oregon, students navigating poverty in Oregon, they're more likely to be white, and then the highest race ethnicity group after that is Hispanic Latino. However, if you ask a different question, you get the blue graph. The blue graph asks, what's the likelihood, if you are in a particular race and ethnicity, that your family is navigating poverty? And then you see, not exactly the opposite, but you see something really different, which is that American Indian, Alaskan Native are over 50% likely to be navigating poverty in our state. And you've got Black and African American at 33%, and then you see the rest of the graph. And the question, the reason this is germane to the discussion that was before the group, which is about consideration of possible legislative concepts or public policy, is how do you account for these things? For instance, I know in housing, I've learned that there's a way to account for this, that although you may give housing services to folks who deserve them based on the red lines, in terms of how you do outreach or how you build professional development around how to access folks in the community around housing, you look at the blue lines, because the blue lines tell you where you have to develop cultural capacity and ability to do culturally responsive services. So this is the kind of thing that the group looked at. In and of itself, it's probably worth a lot of discussion. I'm going to go past it, but I just want to give a sense of the depth of the topic that we considered and some of the variables that we looked at. With respect to federal, state, and local funding, we had presentations from ODE folks on both topics, lots of information, all of which is contained in the report. One big learning that came out that's a basic thing that frankly I think was really important for everyone to consider and is important as we think about any use of state funds too, is how the feds do it. The way the feds fund our schools is, federal government, is that they give poverty to schools and districts based on census data about the level of need. When the money gets to the schools, it's spent based on the academic needs of the student without regard to the status of that student or their family and income. So if I'm in a school that's receiving Title I federal services, and I don't happen to come from a family in, who's navigating poverty, but I'm doing really poorly in math, I will receive extra services for my math to get me up to speed, whereas someone sitting next to me who might have different economic conditions but doing really well won't get a service. And there's a lot of reason behind that, but I just want to lay that out. I think one of the biggest reasons for this is that really what we're trying to do is to increase the academics. That's the goal for it. But there's a lot of depth behind that. With respect to the state funding for the poverty weight, again, a very basic thing that's really important for folks to understand, and the committee really wrestled with understanding it, but it's crucial to grasp, is that the money that we give out on that list of weights that were up there before, the poverty weight is just a revenue formula. That's extra money that comes into school districts or, as you heard, charters or whatever. Poverty is not a way, so it's one of the weights that generate money, but it's not a separate tracked budget item. It's not a program in a school district. It just goes into the large total weight that a school district gets. One of the other things we asked to consider is the sufficiency of the poverty weight. And I want to apologize for a typo on this. That first line should say 0.25 poverty weight. Sorry about that. Quality control. Yeah, exactly. Now that was my quality control. So, but we were asked as a group to consider the sufficiency of the poverty weight. This is not a new topic in Oregon or across the country. There was previous committees that looked at the weighting in Oregon. Our committee had a debate about it. And I think generally I can summarize what the group would say, including experts that have worked with Oregon before, is that our 0.25 poverty weight probably is too low if that's the only weight that we're going to students who are navigating poverty. But it's not. In fact, there's a connection between the poverty weight and all the other weights, or a lot of the other weights. So really, you can't just look at the 0.25 weight and render some kind of judgment without a more comprehensive and perhaps independent sort of assessment of how do things like those other weights interact with the poverty weight and whether it's sufficient or not. And we had a lot of opinion on that, a number of concepts that came up about that, but zero consensus whatsoever about any change to it, but a real interest in maybe continuing to look at it. So that's that further analysis bullet. With respect to the relation of state school fund to achievement, so that's what the report's supposed to do, right? It's supposed to look at all this background data and come to some resolution. Well, one clear thing came through from the research and the discussion, and to my knowledge, it's the first time it's been reported publicly, at least in Oregon, the first time I saw it, which is that data from around the country, this is not just Oregon data, although Oregon, it turns out, was a part of the sample that produces data because we were an equalization state a number of years ago, data on states that equal equalized school funding is a really great place to look to find out how funding affects achievement. And the fact is that funding affects achievement. The more you spend in a school district, the higher achievement you get, period. The effect is 10% of an increase in school district nationwide, and the measure is how many years of schooling do you finish. It's not test score measure because the test scores are unreliable and they differ state to state. But if you spend 10% more in a district, kids complete about 0.3, like a third of a year more of school. But what's really interesting about that is if you spend more in a school district, who gains the most are students in poverty. So for every 10% you spend in a school district nationwide, you get another half a year of attendance in that school, which from a statistician point of view, when you want to look at a statistical effect, is enormous. But the other thing we learned that's sort of a counterbalance to that, it's not just about money, it's also about how additional money is spent. And there's lots of good national research that we should look to corroborate, but that additional spending matters with respect to services to students in poverty. We heard before about the summer slide. That's pretty much universally understood to be a great intervention for students navigating poverty. Finally, what did the work group recommend? Well, we did talk about lots and lots of things and concluded with two consensus recommendations. One, which is the group unanimously expressed the importance of looking at the formula only, if and only if, it's in the context of the remainder of the weights, like special ed, ESL, pregnant parenting, and so on. And secondly, the group, and actually in that first bullet, the group actually recommended that we continue meeting. There was a real engagement with that group and a feeling that, gosh, we just got going on so many of these issues and it's so deep. But so more research, more analysis, more conversation. And secondly, the work group concluded that generally what we're hearing across the state is where things are working best is where there is coordination. And in many cases, there is not coordination among the many different services that exist to students navigating poverty. And that should be a real priority at the state level and with local, at the local level, to do that kind of local work. So I'd just like to conclude by thanking Representative Wisnant and Gallegos for their leadership in prioritizing the examination of this policy. And we look forward to engaging with this committee and the legislature, our education partners, and communities across the state to further these important conversations.
Okay. Anybody have questions, Mr. Trimble?
Thank you for this. Did you talk about, or did your committee maybe suggest looking at the budget coding that's done and maybe changing that so that the actual spending can be tracked more accurately?
Committee Chair Doherty, Representative Reardon. We actually had great representation from school districts. We had superintendents, but we also had like CIO types or chief, you know, the chief.
The ITs.
IT, not just the IT, but the budget side. A lot of testimony on budgeting. I think the key thing is to even do any kind of tracking, we'd have to be that doing that tracking. It's not done yet. So we talked about the fact that it's not tracked and the fact that we'd have to invent something brand new in order to do it. I don't know if that answers your question.
It does. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
We have a state chart of accounts right now that requires districts to report, and this is not something they report on.
Yeah. Any other questions? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Who really is the keeper of the keys on this situation if a district receives a heavier weighting for ESL or whatever? How do we know that those silos are actually being respected? Who's in charge of that?
So, Chair Doherty, Representative Wilson, it's first of all, it's complex because with each of those weights up there, the rules around them, both statewide or federal, it really differ. So we're right in poverty's it has a particular set of requirements, which is, as I've said before, there's not a requirement to track it. But you look at something like special education or ESL, or English Language Learner Services, it's different. So in order to really answer that, we'd almost have to go through each of these and ask at the district level, how do you account for it? Special education, there's tremendous requirements. So each of them's a little bit different, and with each increase in requirement, you have an increase in overhead, so there's that balancing on each of these.
Okay.
So it'd be a longer presentation to answer that for each.
Okay. Did the work group come up with legislation or a legislative fix or a legislative suggestion on this? Or
part of the agenda was to discuss lots of different legislative ideas, but we were not able to come up with consensus.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay, and then with a legislative concept is Representative Jean Wisnant from House District 53.
I've got a dash off. Oh. I need to go.
Good morning, Madam Chair and honorable committee members. For the record, I'm Jean Wisnant, House Representative, State Representative, House District 53. I was the chief sponsor. Vice Chief Sponsor of House Bill 2968, along with Representative Joe Gallegos, Representative Sherry Springer, and Senator Mark Hass. House Bill 2968 passed in the 2015 session, and I appreciate the chair and the committee members for allowing it to pass. It changed from my original concept to a work group. We do that a lot. The bill passed. You've heard, I'll skip this paragraph and to save time, but you did ask, and it was part of the charter to include recommendations for legislation to an interim committee of the Legislative Assembly. And also you heard about the group. I think it's important to know that the group met on 2 days, October the 1st, October the 30th, for a total of 12 hours. That equals 6 days of full committee hearings. So we had a lot of information and good information. And I especially want to commend the Oregon Education Officer, Lindsay Capps, for the leadership of the group. I think it was our first meeting. Oh, he had to leave suddenly because of Roseburg to be there with the governor. It was a tragedy. As you heard from Peter amazes me of his knowledge and research and finding all these things. We had tremendous information, tremendous presentations, and he spent a lot of time and effort. And as you see, we had our last meeting October the 30th, and the report was due November the 15th, and he delivered it November the 15th. I want to quote from the report. And you've heard this. The work group participants shared that they believe that districts would benefit by knowing what works in other districts as part of continuous improvement process. I heard some of the testimony earlier about the representative's bill wanting transfer and accountability. The second statement in the report is the entire group indicated that further discussions and research on the complex topic of sufficiency of the poverty weight would be required. Do we need more? I probably think we do, but how can we justify that if we don't know how we're spending what we have now? The report was produced on November the 15th, 2015. I requested Peter provide me an input for a draft bill soon after I received the draft. I wanted his input and what a legislative bill might look like to address something. Then, to meet the legislative deadline of November the 19th, I submitted an LC bill request, which was different than Peter's draft, I would admit. Okay. And on November the 22nd, I provided Peter a copy of my draft request form. On January the 3rd, I received the LC draft 154 dated 12/30/15. On January the 5th, my office provided Peter a copy and requested he send all work group members a copy and ask for their comments on the LC draft. I received a recommended change. I actually received two recommended changes on January the 5th by work group members. Draft bills are required to be dropped no later than next Tuesday. I have requested inputs on the draft, but due to the time limits of the 2016 short session, the draft will probably be submitted as I have drafted it now, so I can have a hearing scheduled by this very qualified, very outstanding chair. Is that enough? But as I stated, I've requested inputs on the draft bill, but we've got to move it forward. And, Madam Chair, to meet that deadline, I'll request the committee schedule a work session as soon as I receive the bill. But there's time for proposed changes. I've been in the building long enough to know that very seldom does a draft bill get submitted without changes. And I appreciate inputs from members of the committee, and also would love to have members' inputs from this committee because this is an important subject. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions of the good representative? Okay, Representative Frederick.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to thank you. A lot of folks have been talking about dealing with the poverty issue. This work group was really outstanding. I can't say enough good about Peter. He does a remarkable job. His team really is quite extraordinary. But I really want to thank you for continuing this, because we really do need to address those issues that are directly affect poverty. And they are more significant, I think, than just about anything else in terms of our the ability for our students and our kids to succeed. So thank you again for this work.
Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Frederick. That's important. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions, comments? Okay, thank you very much.
Madam Chair, thank you. Have a good day.
And with that, I close the informational hearing on 2986 report. And that's it. Anything else for the good of the order? Okay, thanks much. And we will see you all in February. We are adjourned.
There's no...
February. We are adjourned.
There's no...